Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
And welcome back, Ken.
Thanks.
It's really, really good.
Thank you very much.
To have you back.
Thank you very
here
much.
Here in our studios.
Who did you have last week?
This week, Mara Liasson.
Oh, she's so funny.
She was
she's
a
so
scream.
Wacky. I know,
she is.
I know.
She's nuts. I just don't know what I'm going to believe that she says because it's like all so crazy. Speaking of kind of a little bit out there, what about this new book by Jerome Corsi? We're finding all kinds of interesting things in it. Apparently, one of his sources is Don Gagne, NPR's own White House correspondent and political correspondent who has been a guest on this podcast.
What's interesting about this book is that, first of all, we know that it's filled with falsehoods.
And misrepresentations and of reporting by other people such as Don Gagne,
right. And yet here we are talking about it, and everybody's talking about it and talking about how wrong it is and how incorrect it is. And Sunday's New York Times would be the number one on the bestseller list.
Which is achieved through advanced sales, which are, shall we say, addressable by publisher tactics. But the question here, though, is, I think, what are going to be the effects of the book? They have printed something like 450,000
right.
copies of it. By whatever means, many of them are going to be sold.
It was a kind of a tactics that were used fairly effectively against John Kerry, because there was some kernel of truth to charges made against John Kerry, what he did and what he didn't do, and whether he did what he said he did, and all things like that.
There were two sides to the story of his service in Vietnam
right.
with the Swift boats.
Right. If Jerome Corsi has been so discredited by his association with that book in 2004 and other writings about Catholicism and the Pope and Muslims, here we are looking at this book saying, my goodness, why anybody would take this seriously is beyond us, and yet everybody, they may not be taking it seriously, but they're taking it and talking about it.
The John McCain campaign has had nothing to say about Jerome Corsi's book. They don't want to talk about it. They have not made any kind of indication about whether they're going to use it in their ads or not. They just are basically ignoring it.
Well, although there has been several groups who've demanded that John McCain denounce the book and disassociate himself from that book, but there's no reason for him to do that.
He won't do that.
Because Corsi very cleverly has been a supporter of Chuck Baldwin.
Yes, he's another Chuck Baldwin supporter.
Yeah.
Tell us about Chuck Baldwin,
Chuck
Ken.
Baldwin is the Constitution Party candidate for president, and he's not going to win.
And he will probably win among the members of the
Constitution Party.
All right. It's been a pretty good week for John McCain.
Barack Obama is on vacation in that exotic,
right there,
elitist country of Hawaii.
Yes. What in the world is he doing there? What kind of American would go there?
I mean, was he born there or does a family there?
No. Who knows?
Absolutely not. To his good fortune, although this sounds very crass, but and I usually don't say things that are crass, but the Russian invasion of Georgia was not the worst thing in the world for John McCain to react to.
No.
Because first of all, he's a pal of
the leader of Georgia,
right,
who is very pro-American, educated in the United States.
Sonny Perdue.
Went to law school here, and he had a number of occasions to actually visit with him there in Georgia. So this was perhaps, on the entire global map, the one country that was most in John McCain's wheelhouse, as we say in baseball. This was his sweet spot, and he really hit it all week long.
It had nothing to do with the economy, which we know John McCain does not like to talk about. When we saw Barack Obama during his successful European Mideast tour, John McCain seemed really left out. He has the whole stage to himself. He seems even more aggressive on this issue than George W. Bush does. He says that you can't trust the Russians. You can't certainly look in Putin's soul. But I think this was the kind of opportunity that McCain has been trying to make from the beginning, that he has been tested. He knows these leaders. He's dealt with them. He's spoken on the phone with them personally. And unlike Barack Obama, who's inexperienced and green, that John McCain is the right person for this time.
This really gives him a chance to advertise his credentials.
Right.
And as I say, I mean, no other country does he have this close a relationship with the leader, and the leader being someone so pro-American.
Right.
Of course, a lot of that is not accidental. The man who is John McCain's main foreign policy advisor, Randy Schoenemann, used to be under contract as a lobbyist
right.
for the Georgia leadership and for the country of Georgia. That's the reason John McCain has had so much of a connection to this country and to its leaders. That's not a relationship he could, let us say, reproduce across the map in many other countries.
And I told him that I know I speak for every American when I say to him, today, we are all Georgians.
Ich bin ein Georgian.
Yes, that's an inspiring line, and I think that that's a line we'll see in a lot of John McCain ads and so forth, and that he will be coming back to this particular moment many times.
John McCain may be more hawkish on this crisis than the Bush administration would like, but again, it gives him the opportunity to show him that he knows the players involved, he knows the issues, and he certainly has world opinion on his side. The real news of the week.
Another break for the Republicans, another embarrassment for the Democrats.
I don't know if it's a break for the Republicans, but it certainly spells perhaps the end of the career, political career of John Edwards.
Oh, I think you'd have to posit that. There's really no way John Edwards recovers from this. He's not going to be visible at the convention. He's not going to have any part in a prospective Democratic administration. He is done.
He is not going to be vice president, which I have been pushing, I will say, for the last couple of weeks. And is it anybody's business if John Edwards is having an affair? I will make the argument that no, it is nobody's business. However, what if he had won the Iowa caucuses? What if he were the Democratic nominee for president? Or what if he were on Obama's ticket as a running mate? And in October, the National Enquirer reveals this scandal.
It would be, at the very minimum, a tremendous distraction.
It would have killed the Democratic ticket.
Now, there's another controversy here, which involves hush money, or what appears to be hush money, which was funneled to this woman through a major fundraiser for John Edwards. And this is what John Edwards had to say on that score.
This is what I can tell you. I've never paid a dime of money to any of the people that are involved. I've never asked anybody to pay a dime of money, never been told that any money's been paid. Nothing has been done at my request.
Well, look, he probably didn't pay a dime.
I'm sure he didn't.
Nobody paid a dime. They may have paid tens of thousands of dollars, if not more. But the thing is, Fred Barron, who is his national finance chairman in the 2004 and 2008 presidential campaigns, he took a real Hunter and her baby out of North Carolina, took them to California in a multi-million dollar gated community home in Santa Barbara, I believe it is, or Beverly Hills. I think it's Santa Barbara. And John Edwards and Fred Barron never told John Edwards. John Edwards never asked Mr. Barron about these financial arrangements. He knew nothing about that. That defies credibility.
Let's hear some more of an explanation from former Senator Edwards about how he could be, shall we say, fallen in this way.
Being considered for vice president, running for president, being a vice presidential candidate, and becoming a national public figure, all of which fed a self-focus, an egotism, a narcissism that leads you to believe that you can do whatever you want.
One more thing that I think brings this into the realm of news or doesn't, and that is the contention that had the National Enquirer story been taken more seriously or been more reported back last fall, or if John Edwards had been forced entirely out of the race back last fall, that Hillary Clinton would have won the Iowa caucuses. That, of course, comes from Howard Wolfson, until recently the communications director for her campaign. Any evidence of that?
Well, first of all, the thought of somebody working for Clinton to say that had the media...
Hillary Clinton.
Well, okay, for a Clinton, for the media to should have done their job by outing somebody's sexual history, to me, is just unbelievable.
Well,
but that's
true, but okay. Setting that aside, okay, is there some chance?
Your point, I contend, and polls show that this overwhelmingly, that the second choice of the Edwards people was Barack Obama.
Who, in fact, did win the Iowa caucuses.
Right. So I suspect that had John Edwards been out of the race, Barack Obama would have defeated Hillary Clinton by even a larger margin. But, you know, this is a very strange thing for Wolfson to say less than 2 weeks to go before the Democratic convention opens in Denver. And, again, it talks about the bad lingering blood that is presumably still there between the Obama and Clinton forces.
But at this particular moment in time, as we're recording this podcast, we have learned that, in fact, Hillary Clinton's name is going to be placed in nomination formally at the convention, and that she will be part of a roll call vote on Wednesday night, which presumably would still be won by Barack Obama, but that there will be a roll call vote. This seems to have been a big focus for a lot of Hillary's people, that they wanted to make sure that this happened.
If you look at the record, defeated presidential candidates in previous conventions have had their name placed in nomination. In 1992, when Bill Clinton had a huge convention lead, Nonetheless, Jerry Brown's name was put into to nomination. In 1984, when Walter Mondale had the nomination sewn up, still Gary Hart and Jesse Jackson had their names put into nomination.
In 1988, Michael Dukakis clearly had won, and yet there was a roll call largely as a salute to Jesse Jackson right. and the degree to which he had contested that nomination, even though obviously it wasn't close.
And in fairness, Hillary Clinton has won more delegates and won more votes than any defeated candidate for a presidential nomination in history.
So indeed, she should, by all rights, have at least as much recognition as all these other defeated rivals for past nominations have had. The reason I think this seems strange to some people is we didn't have any contest in 96. Bill Clinton was nominated without opposition. In 2000, Bill Bradley was disposed of so early.
Immediately, right.
That Al Gore was essentially without opposition.
Right.
And then in 2004, really there was no one candidate contesting John Kerry's nomination for very long, except John Edwards, who was then on the ticket by the time we already got to the convention.
Right.
That was already made clear. So that was, in essence, a package deal. But in terms of history, that's the norm. The norm is you have a roll call and all those candidates still with their names and nominations.
But I should tell you that this podcast is being recorded on August 13th, 2008. And the reason I say that is because on August 13th, 1980 was the exact day that Jimmy Carter's name won the nomination at Madison Square Garden. And you had that specter of Ted Kennedy on the platform, almost forced to go up the platform. He didn't endorse Jimmy Carter. He didn't put his arm around him. He didn't hold their arms up together. It was a very...
Oh, not till the very, very end when Carter had to run around on stage and literally find
right,
Teddy
exactly.
Kennedy and grab his arm and rip it up into the air.
Now, there are some Obama...
terribly humiliating and embarrassing spectacle. What does it mean, though, in terms of all this, that Hillary Clinton is not being made the keynote speaker? Apparently, the most featured keynote speaker of the week will be Mark Warner, the former governor of Virginia, now running for the Senate in that state.
Well, if you look at what happened 4 years ago, they took some unknown...
Obscure. Funny ears. Funny name. Guy from Illinois.
Right, Rod Blagojevich.
That was the guy.
Yeah. No, Barack Obama was a keynote speaker. He was a Senate candidate. He was the party's future. A lot of people see Mark Warner as perhaps the party future. He's all but assured to win the Senate race in Virginia this year. And I think looking ahead, if the keynote speaker is to look ahead for the party, I think Mark Warner is a more plausible candidate than Hillary Clinton, who perhaps her best days are behind her.
Quickly, Ken, who do we see now as the most likely vice presidential pick in each party?
Well, I've said for several weeks now, Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota. I have a new Democratic...
Got to tell people that's a Republican. Most people don't know
he's
that.
He's a Republican. I have a new Democratic pick, Jack Reed.
Jack Reed of Rhode Island?
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to be right, Ken.
I know.
I know he's got a great military record. He's been a hero. He's a smart guy.
He really is an impressive, nice man. The war from the beginning.
Yes.
That's the argument against Evan Bayh, who was a cheerleader for the war. He's supposed to be on the short list. And remember, when Barack Obama criticized Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama said, I had the judgment from the beginning to be right on the war. With those words out there, I don't know how you pick an Evan Bayh to be your running mate.
He would have to give a good speech of renunciation for that position, and he would have to be convincingly able to put Indiana in play. I think he's going to be thrown back on either Bayh or one of the Virginians, or he's going to have to find somebody.
Would you have Tim Kaine as a running mate and Mark Warner as a keynoter?
It seems unlikely,
yeah.
But if that were the choice they wanted to make, I don't think they would scruple it. I know that it seems as though you wouldn't have both, but if that's the choice they think would help them the most in November, I think they would make it. I'm looking to be surprised. I think they're going to come up with a name we're not talking about right now. Maybe it means they talk somebody like Ted Strickland into changing his mind and running in Ohio. I think that would be a huge breakthrough for him and help him on
five levels.
If he could get Strickland to change his mind in Ohio. But we'll have to wait and see. Because that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/elections.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, this could be our last podcast before we find out a VP choice.
I think we'll know a little bit more. So join us next week for It's All Politics from NPR News.
Goodbye, Johnny. Goodbye, Johnny. Schön war's mit uns zwei. Aber leider kann's nicht immer so sein. Goodbye, Johnny, goodbye, Johnny. Mach's mir nicht so schwer.